Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of Torah Studies. This is our Purim class, and today we learn about the connection between Purim and Woodstock. Purim and Woodstock. I feel like Alex Trebek. For 200, please. Who was the villain of Purim? So, wait, no, that's how you answer the question. All right, here we go. Yes, he was the villain of Purim. So let us jump into the story. First thing I want to do is start off with a quick overview of the Purim story, just so that everybody is up to speed. And we'll highlight some important events. Take and pass, please. Just one sheet. I'll go through this. These are bullet point by bullet point. And we will then pick it up with the conversation. Okay. Overview of the Purim story as found in the Megillah, Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther, by the way, you should know him, Arneen. Megillas Esther was the last book to be canonized in the Jewish scripture. There are 24 holy books in Judaism. The Megillah, Megillas Esther, was the last one to be included. And it says that Esther herself petitioned the sages to get it included officially as part of... Remember we spoke about the Apocrypha, those texts that were not included? So Esther was the last one to get in. Okay, so here we go. Purim story overview. We're using this this list. So we begin with King Ahasuerus throwing a 180-day feast to celebrate his reign and the 70-year exile of the Jewish people. That's how the story, the book of Esther, begins. The Jews attend the feast against Mordechai's orders. Mordechai was one of the Jewish leaders, one of the great Jewish leaders, head of the Sanhedrin, the high Jewish court, and he told the Jews not to participate, especially since part of the agenda of the feast, as mentioned in the first point, was to celebrate the fact that, according to his calculation, the 70-year exile of the Jewish people had already, 70 years had already elapsed since the Jews had gone into exile. There had been a Jewish prophecy stating that after the first temple was destroyed, that the Jews would be in exile for 70 years and then would go out of exile and rebuild the second temple. So at the end of 70 years, he threw a party. 70 years have passed, no second temple. Sorry, Jews. So that's why, again, that's one of the agendas why he threw the party. He had the vessels of the Holy Temple. He used various items from the temple at the actual feast. But the Jews attended. Queen Vashti, number three, Queen Vashti is killed for failing to appear before the men at the feast. And by the way, you should know that in the Megillah it says that the king asked her to come in the royal, that she should appear before the men at the feast in wearing the royal crown. According to the Talmud, it means wearing only the royal crown. She refused. He had her killed. Next, Ahasuerus throws a royal beauty pageant and Esther is chosen as the new queen. Mordechai, Esther's cousin, makes her swear that she will not reveal that she is a Jew. Now, you should know that according to the Talmud, according to some opinions in the Talmud, Mordechai and Esther were not just cousins, they were also married. Mordechai and Esther were actually husband and wife. Mordechai discovers Bigthan and Zeresh's assassination plot and saves the king's life. Mordechai was also a minister to the king. He overhears this plot of assassination being spoken in a foreign language, but Mordechai, as the head of the Sanhedrin, had to know all 70 world languages at the time. 70 major world languages, so he understood the language, he decoded the plot, shared it with Esther passed it along, and indeed these two other ministers or officers, whatever, were killed. Next, Haman is appointed prime minister, and everyone is told to bow to him. Mordechai, however, refuses to bow to Haman. Haman is incensed. Haman decides that he wishes to destroy all the Jews and casts lots, which are poor. Pur is a lot in Persian. Purim is plural for lots. So he casts Purim, essentially, to determine the day that the extermination plot should be carried out. The lots fall on the 13th day of the following Adar. So this was almost a year later was when these lots fell. It was almost 12 months that the Jews were kind of under this threat. You should also know that the way he did it was he created two messages. The first one said, by order, it was a sealed thing that people opened, royal decree, the king has determined that on the 13th day of whatever, however that worked out to whatever calendar they use, but on that day, there is a people that everyone should kill and should get rid of. but it didn't reveal who that was until a second letter was to go out and reveal that. But Mordechai found out about that, and that's how the rest of the story plays out. So, oh, but before we get there, I'm sorry, I jumped the gun a little bit. Haman approaches Ahasuerus offering payment for permission to kill the Jews. Ahasuerus agrees and refuses payment. He says, you don't have to pay me. Go take care of it. No problem. Haman sends out the royal decree that all Jews will be killed on the 13th of Adar. And that this is where I should have mentioned it, in two letters. One, the first letter that says a nation. The second letter sealed only to be opened at a later date. Clearly somebody couldn't hold themselves back and open up the second letter. Next, Mordechai, finding out about the decree, mourns and asks Esther, he sends a message to Esther, to go to the king and intervene on her people's behalf. Esther fears for her life and is initially hesitant. So Esther says to Mordechai, I can't go to the king and intercede because he hasn't called me in 30 days. And if I just show up unannounced, he might kill me. So she's hesitant. Esther agrees, however, to go to the king if Mordechai will gather the Jews and fast for 3 days together with her. She's going to fast for 3 days. Mordechai and the Jews should fast for 3 days. And then she says, after that, I'll go to the king. Okay, which is why, parenthetically, we have, even till this day, we have a fast preceding the holiday of Purim called Highness Esther, the Fast of Esther. It's not a three-day fast. It's just a morning till evening fast. So it's going to start on Wednesday morning at sunrise, which is probably, I don't know, 5-6 o'clock in the morning, and it goes until just about 6:45. So you should know for that, for our Purim party, which we're calling for 5:45, we'll have food, and again, whoever wants. I mean, mainly it's officially food for the kids, and then we'll do Megillah. Then everyone can you know participate. Okay, let's keep it moving here with this overview. Esther, after those 3 days, approaches the king and requests that the king and Haman come for a feast. Okay. At that feast, Esther asked him to come to another feast, the second feast. Haman, all super happy with himself, leaves the palace and sees Mordechai and grows very angry. Haman asks his family what to do about this Mordechai Jew fellow. He's probably Jewish. And they come up with a plan to hang Mordechai on the gallows. They build some gallows really tall. And okay, that night, Haman heads to the palace to request permission from the king to hang Mordechai. Meanwhile, the king can't sleep and has read the story of Mordechai saving his life and decides to repay him. Is the story clear so far?
Yeah.
Moving too fast? Okay. Yeah. All right. When Haman arrives, the king asks what he suggests be done for one whom the king wishes to honor. Haman replies lavishly. He thinks big, thinking that the king is referring to him, Haman. The king surprises Haman and tells him to do exactly this for Mordechai, his archenemy. Haman is humiliated, and then after that humiliation of dressing and getting Mordechai all dressed up and then leading him through the streets, he then has to rush to the queen's second feast. Esther discloses at that feast that she is a Jew and that Haman wants to kill her and her people. The king orders that Haman be hung or hanged on the very gallows that he prepared for Mordechai. A new decree was sent out giving the Jews permission to fight back. The Jews overcame their enemies on the 13th of Adar and celebrate their salvation on the 14th. Jews in Shushan, the capital, fought for an additional day and celebrated their salvation on the 15th of Adar. The holiday of Purim was established thereafter for the Jewish people, and the Book of Esther was penned. Of course, we have four mitzvot, four things that we do in commemoration of the day to celebrate the day. Number one is reading the story of Purim in the Book of Esther. Number two is sending gifts of food to a friend. Number three is giving gifts of money to the poor. And the fourth is to have a festive feast. So it's within this fourth category of the festive feast that we pick it up in our Torah studies text on the holiday of Purim. So let's begin with text number one. This is a very interesting statement from the Talmud that requires a lot of explanation. And you should know, many commentaries discuss it. We're going to discuss it. We'll say commentaries. And as you'll see, we're eventually going to where we're headed is we're going to present an exposition, explanation that the Rebbe gave in 1970 on the holiday of Purim, which is unbelievable, connected with Woodstock and the hippie movement. So stay tuned and buckle up. Text number one. Lisa, please begin. From the Talmud, Tractate Megillah, which is all about the holiday of Purim.
The custom of drinking on Purim.
Yes.
Rava said, it is the duty of a man to imbibe himself with wine on Purim until he cannot discern between Cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordecai.
What do we call that?
Dead drop.
Smash. Total inebriation. Right, continue, please.
Rabbah and Rabbi Zera joined together in a Purim feast. They imbibed, and Rabbah arose and cut Rabbi Zera's throat. On the next day, he prayed on his behalf and revived him.
You should know in the original it says, come Rabbah, Rabbah got up, shachte le Rabbi Zera. It's in Aramaic. He shechted. You know what shecht means? Slaughtered him. Killed him. The next day, when he sobered up, the implication is, he prayed and came back to life. Continue, please. It gets even better.
The next year, he said, will your...
One second. Continue.
The next year, he said, will your honor come and we will have the Purim feast together? He replied, a miracle doesn't happen every time.
So Reb Zera is again, hey, you want to come over? He's like, no, not happening. Not happening. You want to come to my place? Yeah, not happening again. Fool me once, right? Kill me once. Shame on you. Okay, here we go. So this is the Talmudic, passage. A lot of questions on this. Before I ask my questions, what questions do you have? Any questions on this? I'm sure there are many questions. Fire away.
How do you get revived?
How do you get revived? Okay, good.
How much is too much drinking?
Good.
Why did he want to kill him?
Yeah. Why was that part of the festivities? It's like, hey, let's kill somebody. Like, what is that? Like, how does that happen? Turn violent. What else? By the way, not all these questions will I answer. I just want to know what questions you have. No, I'm literally not going to answer every question. What else?
How do you get drunk enough to not know the difference without passing out first?
Okay. You're saying in general how to fulfill that first paragraph. Okay. Good. What else? Anybody have a more essential question on the whole thing, on the whole premise? What's the premise of the Talmud? That you're supposed to get
drunk.
Does anybody have a question on that?
I don't know if that's, you know, I've heard different things.
Well, hold on. So there's a lot of commentaries on it. But the commentaries are really addressing the question that I'm about to ask, that I'm trying to kind of evoke or provoke. The question is, what's going on here? Why are we getting drunk? You have to listen to the Megillah, give gifts of food to friends, give money to the poor, and eat a festive meal. What's the business of getting drunk? Now, we know on Passover, there's 4 cups of wine. Okay, it doesn't say not to know, drink 4 cups of wine until you don't know the difference between Pharaoh and Moses. That never happened. It's not a thing, right? Why suddenly Purim, it's like you have to get drunk? Or at least from the simple language of the text. That you have to get so inebriated, you don't even know the difference between the hero and the villain in the story. What's going on? Why the drinking? What's up with that? Question number one. Question number two. These are my questions now, right? Although everyone had good questions, and maybe we'll touch on some of them. Question number two is, if you want to say that for whatever reason you're supposed to get drunk, so just say it. You're supposed to drink it until you get inebriated. Why does it use a very interesting way of explaining it? Until you can't tell the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordecai. Like, why is that the litmus test? Okay, because of the main character of the story. Fine, but it's like a weird thing. Why not, until you can't tell the difference between a Megillah and a cactus? I mean, like, use something else. Why, like, what's, right? You like that one. You weren't expecting that little analogy to fly right in. Like, you weren't expecting me to come into the frame right there. So many things are unexpected in it. Right? So why, it's not just telling us this very interesting and curious din, this law of getting inebriated in the first place, which, you know, begs explanation. But even more so, how inebriated, so you don't know the difference between Mordecai and Haman. Cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordecai. Why is that the thing? Yeah. Right.
Really, it was that you get so high on praise God that you know that you realize that nothing happens without God's. You know,
yeah.
That everybody, you're just high on right. Spirituality.
Again, there are definitely interpretations that seem. Definitely explanations that channel that idea. But again, more from a simple understanding that there's a lot to ask. And then, of course, the question of Rabban Rabbi Zera. Why is he shechting him? Why is he reviving him? Well, I guess that makes sense. Why is he inviting him the next year? So many questions. And again, we might not answer all these questions.
We know why he's not going.
We definitely know why he's not going. That is the most, of all of these things, that last line makes a lot of sense. He's like, I'm not relying on this again.
So,
not going to happen.
Is this another example of resurrection?
Yes. Yes. Hey. Yes.
So that's a theme that is presented more than once. I mean, resurrection is discussed in the Torah.
There is, yeah. There's resurrection alluded to in the Torah, and there is resurrection mentioned in Scripture. What else is there?
Is this from Talmud?
From the Talmud, yeah.
So it's mentioned a lot. So Christianity stole resurrection from us as well?
Yeah, they lifted it. Raising the roof. Oh, man. We were on a bus yesterday.
That's very central to their beliefs.
Yeah, totally. They got all the good stuff from us. Now, it's funny, like we were on a bus, almost looked like this, but it didn't. Coach bus to the airport to LaGuardia. LaGuardia, if anybody's been there recently, they're doing a lot of construction.
That's been going for 25 years.
Right, okay.
But it's really bad now.
It's really bad now. It's a total mess. Total mess.
What kind of accommodations do you have to?
We're in a coach, oh no, so I'm saying we're in a coach bus now, and like we pull in and we start hitting these things. And those things are like telling you that you have to make another plan because you're about to get the top of your vehicle chopped off by this low overpass. So we get there, and there's really nothing to do in a massive coach bus. So we had to like have a cop pull like whole traffic and back all the way up. My point was, though, that this is the only time that no one should say raise the roof. You don't want to do that. But resurrection is a Jewish thing. Now, so the core question is, the Talmud says,
Resurrection was a Jewish thing.
Total Jewish thing.
Yeah.
Total Jewish thing. 13th principle of Jewish faith as articulated by Maimonides. Makes the top 13. Now, let's recap quickly. The Talmud says that there's a mitzvah on Purim to drink ad lo yada, until you don't know the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. And our question is, what? Why is there a mitzvah to drink? To have a festive meal, fine. We're supposed to have a festive meal on Shabbos and Yom Tov. But why to get... Why to drink, and why to get inebriated, and why is this being the litmus test of not knowing the difference between Haman and Mordechai? Oh, and one more question. The whole holiday of Purim celebrates what? The entire holiday, what is it celebrating?
It celebrates the survival of the Jewish people.
Right, and really the victory, if you want to put it into characters, the victory of Haman and the victory of Mordechai and Esther over Haman. So on a day that's what you're celebrating, you're supposed to get so drunk that you mix up the story? You understand what I'm saying? The whole thing doesn't make any sense. You with me on that last point? It really doesn't make sense. Now, you could say, you're supposed to drink because that's a festive mood, perhaps, or whatever, and then try to like work around that first question, even the second question. This is how do you know that you're so drunk? Because the good guy is the bad guy is the good guy. But the third question is the strongest. The whole day is celebrating the victory of the Jews. So you're on that day, you're supposed to forget who's right and who's wrong? You're supposed to think that the bad guy is the good guy? And maybe we should have lost? Maybe Haman was right all along? Maybe we shouldn't be eating his hat? Haman's like, if that Jew Mordechai wins, I'll eat my hat. And we're like, no, but we will. But we will. And we do. Anyway, so you with me on the questions? Question number one, what's the business, what's this drinking thing? Question number two, why is it cursed be, not knowing the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai? Number three, why on the day of Purim are we trying to get the story wrong? It makes no sense. Okay, here we go. So all the commentaries deal with this, all the commentaries. Let's review a few of them. Peter, please read text number two, Abu Dram. He deals with this. Oh, let me set this up. What he basically says, he deals with the question about the cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. Why are you drinking? Let's say you're supposed to be festive and eat, drink, and be merry, and that includes being a little bit inebriated. Fine, let's let that part slide. But why should you not know the difference between Mordechai and Haman? So he explains that it doesn't mean that literally. It means, in a certain way, it means non-literal. Please read.
It is stated in the first chapter of Tractate Megillah that a person must be married on Purim to the extent that he can no longer discern between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. Some explain that the words cursed be Haman have the same numerical value as blessed be Mordechai. The Talmud wishes to tell us that a person should be married to the extent that he can no longer make that calculation.
Understand how he's changing it? What he's saying is like this. The gematria, the numerical value of Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai, cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai, Arur Haman, Baruch Mordechai, those two equal the same amount. I was trying to do this last night right after my flight, and it was not, or maybe even on the plane, and it was not working. I got 502 for one and 504 for the other. So all bets are off. I don't even know. Oh, I got it. I can't make that calculation. This is a total self-fulfilling prophecy here. Interpretation. Anyway, bottom line is that they have the same numerical equivalent, whatever that number is. We'll have to revisit that at a later point. So what he's saying is, when the Talmud says you're supposed to drink until you don't know the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai, it doesn't mean until you don't know the difference between the characters, the good guy and the bad guy. It means until you don't know the difference, until you can't make the calculation of the numerology of cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. In other words, drink enough that your math is a little bit less effective than it would be ordinarily. Continue, please. Let me just set this up. This is another interpretation, follows along the same lines, but instead of numerology, it's about songs, singing.
And Min Hagat writes as follows. Talmud is referring to a certain poem written in responsive format. For every stanza, the refrain would be either blessed be Mordechai or cursed be Haman in alternating order. One would need a clear head to keep track, for if one is not paying close attention, they can make a mistake and say the wrong refrain.
So what that means is you're supposed to drink enough that you can't sing the song correctly anymore. Right? 100 bottles of beer on the wall, 100 bottles of beer, one fella, how does it go?
One down, pass it around.
Take one down, pass it around. Another song. Yeah, 95 bottles of beer on the wall. Oh, messed it up. So the point is that you're supposed to drink enough that you can't. It's like, you messed up the song. I messed up the song. Brawl. And guy gets shechted. So that's the way. Joking. That's text one. Check it out. Rabzera and Rabba.
But that's sort of.
Reb Zera is like, Rabbi, you killed it this year. He's like, I killed it. So here's the thing. According to this, it doesn't mean literally you shouldn't know the difference between the good guy and the bad guy. What it means is that you shouldn't be able to do mathematical calculations, or you shouldn't be able to sing the song correctly, stanza by stanza, which is fine. Right? That's what it means. That's the Abu Dram. The question still is, why are we drinking in the first place? Why are we drinking to the point that we can't do math? Maybe we need to do math. But how many corners does this Hamantashen have? Who knows? Drink too much. Why is that a good thing? Why are we drinking in the first place? Why are we drinking so that we can't sing the song? The songs are good. We love the songs. Songs forever. So why? So we're still left with some questions on the Abu Dram. Let's go to the Ramah. The Ramah, text number 3, gives another interpretation. Here we go. Marnie, please read this one. The Ramah says, nah, you're not supposed to get stone drunk and inebriated. It doesn't mean that. Page 164.
Some suggest that there is no need to get so inebriated. Rather, one should drink a bit more than what they are accustomed to and fall asleep. While sleeping, he automatically will not be able to differentiate between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. Regardless, for one who increases or one who adds, the important thing is to do it for the sake of heaven.
Yeah, so the Ramah says you don't have to get drunk. You drink a little bit, just a little bit, so that you fall asleep. And when you're sleeping, then you don't have your conscious mind. You're not thinking rationally, so you don't know the difference between Mordechai and Haman, etc. And that's how you fulfill the Talmudic charge or mandate of drink until you don't know the difference. It doesn't mean get so drunk. It means drink, say a little l'chaim, fall asleep, and then you're good. Make sense? Many have the custom to do that today. This is how many, many, many people do it. By the way, I don't know if you noticed this, in the last paragraph doesn't make sense. regardless, for the one who increases or one who adds. That's like, I once heard somebody in a talk say, if you can't beat him, fight him. No. No, that was messed. No, that's not even a thing. Right? If you can't beat him, fight him. So, can't beat him, fight him. Think about that one.
You actually heard somebody say that?
Yeah, it was in a sermon. It just came out because, you know, it's so much talking. Stuff just comes out. Anyway, in the Hebrew, it's echad amarbe ve'echad amamit, whether one adds or decreases. In other words, whether you drink more or less, it's all good. The Rama says, don't drive yourself too crazy to have to drink so much. Whatever, just drink a little bit, you're fine. Okay, that's the Rama.
I don't understand. Do it for the sake of heaven.
Yeah, it meaning that you shouldn't just drink because it's a party. You should drink because that's the way you celebrate Purim. So have in mind, I'm not drinking because I'm drinking. I'm drinking for Purim. Drink a little bit, fall asleep, and you're done. That's what he says. The problem is, it doesn't sound like that's the literal meaning of the Talmudic thing, right? Talmud says, supposed to drink until you don't know the difference between Mordechai and Haman. It means drink so that you sleep and then don't know the difference. It's like he threw in sleep in between. It's not like the direct interpretation. You with me?
So that's the point that Marnin made. Drink, do it for the sake of heaven.
Well, no. I think Marnin was referring to another interpretation, which we don't actually have here, and that is that on a spiritual level, we should transcend Mordechai and Haman, etc., like it's on a spiritual thing. That's also an interpretation. We don't have it here. The Taz has a very interesting interpretation. Taz is a commentary on the Rama, which we just read in text 3. Text number 4. Alex, please read this one, 165.
Okay. How can we do away with the words of the Talmud that state, until he cannot differentiate between cursed be Haman, etc.? The ruling was overridden, as can be proven, from the fact that the Talmud thereafter cites the story of Rabbah, who killed Zerah. It's understood that the Talmud cites the story to conclude that we not to do so.
Yes, so the Taz, by the way, I realize I've been saying it wrong. It was Rabbah who killed Rabbi Zerah, not the other way around. Sorry, guys. Messed that one up. Yeah, Rabbah killed, and I killed the story. Rabbah killed Rabbi Zerah, and what the Taz is saying is in the Talmud itself, it's debunking Rava's teaching. There's Rava and Rabbah. Rava is the one that says to get drunk until you don't know the difference in cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. And then it tells the story of Rabbah and Rabbi Zerah, and Rabbah killed Rabbi Zerah seemingly because he got so inebriated. And the Taz is saying that is the Talmud telling you not to follow what you just read. Rava says to drink until you don't know the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. And the Talmud then says, but maybe you don't want to do that because look at what happened here. Right, so basically, exactly. In other words, the Talmud is giving us a cautionary tale, and therefore the conclusion is, so don't do it. This is the Taz's opinion. So according to this, maybe you don't have to drink at all on Purim, more than whatever you're going to eat or drink in the feast. Fine, listen, these are different interpretations. We're still kind of stuck with this idea. When you read it on a basic level, it does seem to be talking about drinking and not knowing the difference between Haman and Mordechai. So we're going to understand this on a, not on a literal level. We're going to understand this on a spiritual level. But within the spiritual level, we are going to make some peace with the idea that we're not meant to know the difference between Mordechai and Haman. Because that's really a sticking point. No matter how much you're drinking or not drinking, why are we not meant to know the difference between the good guy and the bad guy? That seems to be a very important part of the story, knowing who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. That seems to be an essential part of Purim.
Is it forgiving and not holding a grudge?
I don't know. We killed him. We killed Haman. He was hanged. He was the bad. His 10 sons were hanged. They killed him. I don't know. Like, we're not. We didn't forgive him so easily.
They were hung twice.
Were they hung twice?
Well, it says at the end, after they were hung.
They hung him again?
They asked to hang him again in the future.
Oh.
Or hang them again tomorrow.
Right. And then there's this this notion. You know this one about, do you know the one about
the Nazis?
That is
so spooky.
Such a crazy story.
What?
I don't even know it anymore.
Well, after they go through the 10 sons being hung, I guess it's Mordechai who asks, or maybe Esther asks the king, for permission to hang them again tomorrow. But tomorrow also means in the future.
By the way, my kids do that all the time. Yesterday is any time in the past, and tomorrow is any time in the future. So notice that with kids? Everyone's going to go down with laughter tonight. It's going to happen. Right? Sorry. But
also, the names are written with, some have large letters, and some have small.
Let me explain. In the text of the Megillah, toward the end, where it lists the 10 sons of Haman that were hanged. Hung or hanged? I'm saying hanged. I don't even know if that's true.
Hungman.
Oh, is this just hung?
They were hung.
I thought it was hanged.
I thought it was hanged, too.
I feel like... I don't know anymore. All right, you're on that. You're going to be a research person. What's the point? When they list the 10 sons, there's some letters that are smaller or larger, and it spells the letters Tav Shin Zion, which is 1947.
Oh,
yes.
Gosh.
And
in 1947, there were 10 Nazis that were killed.
That they have the trial.
Yes, the Nuremberg trials, yeah. And the last one, what did he say?
They hung 10... conspirators,
yeah.
Nazi conspirators, so that's the 10 that they hung. The last one yelled Purimfest 1947 or something.
He yelled Purimfest 1947.
And then
that was his last words. Yeah.
That Haman had a daughter.
Yes.
Who was also killed.
She threw herself off the roof after she poured garbage on her father. You know the story? When Haman was, when Haman was leading Mordechai through the streets to honor him, so his daughter thought that it was Haman that was being honored. She couldn't see. She was looking down from, like, they were running through the streets and they lived in the apartment or whatever it was, high rise, penthouse. And so she took, like, it wasn't just garbage, it was like human waste, it was like waste. And she poured a bucket on the leader and it went on him and he looked up and she saw her father. And he saw her and she's like, whoops. And so she threw herself, my bad, and she threw herself off the roof.
Oh my gosh.
So.
Turns out there was an 11th.
Turns out there was an 11th.
Who?
Who was in jail, who killed himself, who happened to be a transvestite.
So suicide, yeah.
So we have.
The parallels. Yeah. Very, very. It's absolutely incredible.
Is this all Megillah? No.
One second. Megillah was written over 2,000 years ago, 2,300 years ago. The large and small letters. Yeah. It's in the scroll.
Okay.
But this story is 1947. We're talking about.
No, of course.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about that story.
It's so. I'm just making sure. Listen. I'm just clarifying. Clarity is king.
Who
came up with that?
Who discerned this? I mean,
it's a thing. You know what? I can even show you downstairs if you can sneak in after the class downstairs. I can show. We have a Megillah under the ark, and I can show you, or we can pull it up here. I can show you the letters. Every letter is usually a median size. It's usually the standard size. There are three letters that are smaller.
So is
the larger.
But is the greater, deeper meaning that key events?
Sometimes, yeah.
Are like in the cards?
You have to understand. Everything is in the Torah, but it's not like we can figure out beforehand what's going to happen. But in retrospect, you can certainly see how things are in the Torah.
What were the three letters in the
Tav Shin Zion, 1947.
I mean, it's so amazing.
Yeah, it's wild. Purimfest. But just Google Purimfest 1947.
Or Megillah codes, Megillah Esther codes.
Yeah.
Let me write that down. Say it again.
There's another one.
Megillah Esther codes.
Chabad.org.
Yeah.
Where if you start from the first mem.
Yeah. No.
You start the first mem in Megillah.
Yeah.
And there are, I forget how many words there are, how many letters there are.
Okay.
You do letter skips.
Yeah.
You keep going around, it spells Megillah Esther.
Interesting. Huh. That's cool.
By the way, it's hang.
Fun with Megillah.
It is hang. Mm-hmm. I thought so.
It says the pictures can be hung, but people are always hanged.
Right. Always. All the people. All the people all the time. All right. That's what I thought. All right, let's move on. Let's move on. So, what are we left with? I want to be left with a question, because otherwise, we're out of business here. Right? What are we doing after the next? All right, we're still left with a question. The question is, okay, we're drinking. We're not really sure why we're drinking. It's like a holiday, but like other holidays, you just have a FFS meal and call it a day. But we're drinking a little bit, okay? But then the whole point is to not know the difference between the villain and the hero. And that is a fundamental problem. Because the whole point of Purim is to celebrate the good guys over the bad guys and the downfall of the bad guys. And the whole, that's the whole point. We read the story of the Megillah to get clarity on good and evil, on the difference between the good guys and the bad guys, and good and evil, and all that stuff. So why are we suddenly supposed to blur the lines? So I'll give you the point. The Rebbe, and the Rebbe said this in 1970, and he said this amidst the 6 months after Woodstock, amidst all of the upheaval of the hippie movement. And what he said was, I'm giving you the kernel of the answer, and then we're going to develop it. Here's the kernel of the answer. But to understand the kernel of the answer, I just want to restate the kernel of the question again. Why are we blurring the lines between the good guy and the bad guy? And the answer is, because to really know who the good guy and the bad guy is, to really know the difference between good and evil, you have to blur the line sometimes. Because what you thought you knew about the difference between right and wrong sometimes doesn't hold up. And sometimes you have to shatter that convention, that notion of right and wrong, to reach a deeper understanding of what right and wrong really is. And he said that's what the hippies were doing. They were breaking what their parents told them was right and wrong, ultimately, hopefully, to arrive at a deeper understanding of that on their own. But again, the message for us is, and again, this is the kernel, this is the nekuda, this is the point which we're then going to develop. This is the chachma, this is the point which we will develop now, in a moment. But the point is that that celebrating Purim means that you're breaking the notions of right and wrong that existed on a very basic level. You're shattering, you're blurring the lines in order to arrive at something much deeper. Kind of makes sense as far as structure, the structure of the answer? In other words, if the point of Purim is to have clarity on who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, why are we blurring the lines? Because you need to blur the lines to really get clarity. I'm just thinking of an eye doctor. They take off your glasses and they make it blurry only to get you clearer than before. I like that one. I'm going to use it tonight. Right? It's like I'm having trouble seeing. Make it better. So let me take off your glasses and make it even worse.
Put drops in your eye.
In order to make it better. Right. It's like they right. Sort of, kind of. Let's get into it. Let's jump into it. So in order to understand this structure, I've given you the structure, right? Clarity is good. So why the blurring? Why the drinking? Why the blurring? Because to get to real clarity, you have to blur, destroy the clarity that you thought you had to arrive at something greater. That's the structure. Let's fill in. There's a subplot, or there's a subtext, there's a backstory to Haman and Mordechai, to the good guy and the bad guy, or the bad guy and the good guy. Who were they? Haman. Who was Haman? Let's read this inside. David, are we up to you? Text 5, 166.
It was taught in the Bereita, Haman was the barber of the village of Khartoum for 22 years.
He was a village barber. Yeah. He was the first guy to start a barbershop. No, because that has four. He was into threes, the trio. He did a barbershop trio. He was a barber for 22 years. He was a simple barber, simple village barber. He was not a big shot. Eventually, he worked his way in. You know, you cut the right people's hair, you start knowing.
They were also.
You start knowing things.
At some point in the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, I think, they were like medicine men. They were bloodletters.
Could be. Oh, yeah, they were bloodletters. Yeah, at some point. I don't know if that was then.
Yes. Blue and red.
Yes.
Kind of represents the vein in the artery.
Yep. Yeah, I've read that before. Yeah, no, for sure. Because they had the razors.
They were bloodletters.
They were the bloodletters.
That was a way of treating disease.
Yes, right. That's what we strive. That's Torah studies. Learning so much every time.
Talking about
all the times.
The word that comes to me when he says barber.
Yeah.
is there was a Nazi that was had a moniker, if that's the name.
The Barber.
The Barber of Seville.
Yeah.
I think is.
I don't know.
What?
I've heard of the Barber of Seville. I don't know.
Oh, maybe that's.
Who knows? That's another Megillah. Shakespeare. But is the Barber of Seville good? We don't know. Bottom line is, the point of this, though, is that he seems to be somewhat of a simple fellow. Now, Mordechai, on the other hand, was a Talmud Chacham. He was a scholar. He was a rabbi. He was a leader. Head of Sanhedrin. He knew 70 languages. He was a minister to the king. This guy was a big shot. At some point in time, they met, way before the Megillah story, they met and went on a mission together. A fateful mission that would change the course, that would change everything and then lead into the Megillah that we know. This story is not in the Megillah, it's in the Midrash Yalkut Shimoni. Karen, please read this one, text 6a.
It happened once that the king sent Mordechai and Haman on a mission to conquer a certain territory and gave them some money. Haman took his portion of the money and spent it all. When they arrived and needed to spend the money on war, Haman had nothing left, whereas Mordechai still had half of the money. Haman approached Mordechai and asked him, "Lend me some of the money that you have." Mordechai replied, "I will not lend you the money until you sell yourself to me." Haman accepted, borrowed the money, and wrote, "Haman is the servant of Mordechai." Haman essentially sold his life to Mordechai for a loaf of bread.
Right?
Sounds like some lentil soup.
Sounds like lentil soup action, Esav of Vinyakov, similar type of thing. It says that Mordechai had Haman write this contract and sign it on the bottom of his shoe. And every time Haman, later on in the story, when Haman gets promoted, so when everyone's bowing down, it says Mordechai, he didn't bow his head, nor did he fall down to him. It says in the commentaries, he showed him his shoe. He's like, "I'm bowing to you, you're my slave." And Haman was not so happy about that, text 6b. Oh, it's old blood. It's bad blood. Yeah, that's my point. Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's a grudge, man. It's a cage match. Karen, one more.
One more?
6B.
Okay. Haman said, "Yet all this avails me nothing."
This is what he complained to his family. He's like, "I have all this power. I have all this prestige. And yet it's all worth nothing because Mordechai is not bowing down to me." That bothered him. He had everything, but he didn't have one guy that bothered him because he knew what it meant.
Right.
Continue. This is what the Talmud explains.
Rabbi Elazar said in the name of Rabbi Hanina, "When Haman saw Mordechai sitting in the king's gate, he said, 'Yet all this avails me nothing.' This may be understood as was suggested by Rav Chista. For Rav Chista said, 'Mordechai came as one with the heritage of a rich man, whereas Haman came as one with the heritage of a poor man. As Mordechai had been Haman's slave master and was aware of Haman's lowly lineage. Rav Papa said, 'And he was called the slave who was sold for a loaf of bread.'"
That was his stage name. That was his, like, what's it called again? His wrestling name. The slave who was sold for a loaf of bread, right? I mean, that's like, that's what he was known for. So what that means is that he came from a low place. He was a barber. He had sold himself to Mordechai. Mordechai, on the other hand, was a scholar and a leader and a sage and a minister. And if you had to rank who was higher than the other, who was low and who was high, Haman was low and Mordechai was high. Now, at a certain point, and we even have this later on. Continue, please. 7a. Amy.
"But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's behest, which was brought by the hand of the chamberlains, and the king became very wroth, and his anger burned within him. And the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for so was the king's custom, to present the case before all who knew law and judgment. And the nearest to him were Karshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Marish, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who saw the king's face, who sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, which shall be done to Queen Vashti, inasmuch as she did not comply with the order of the king, brought by the hand of the chamberlains."
Okay, continue 7b. This is the point.
"When Memucan princes, not against the king alone has Vashti the queen done wrong, but against all the princes and all the people who are in all King Ahasuerus.
I don't even know how to pronounce that. I would just go Ahasuerus.
Provinces.
So there are seven advisors, and it says princes, seven advisors. And the last one, there it says Memuchan. It's Memuchan in the Hebrew, Memuchan. The last one is Memuchan. And the Megillah continues, as the book of Esther continues to say, it's Memuchan who gives the advice, who says, you should know that by Vashti not appearing before the king, it's not a one-time incident, but all the women in the land are going to hear about this, and they're all going to start not listening to their husbands, and everyone, all the husbands are going to blame you. You're the first guy who didn't put his foot down, and now we're all suffering. It's unbelievable, right? It's unbelievable. So, and he's just, so he's like, well, what should I do? Memuchan says, you have to kill her and then make a statement. And he does. Who is Memuchan? Haman. Haman is Memuchan. What's the point of all of this? Number one, he gives really bad advice. And he's super...
hysterical.
Not, I mean, terrible. He's a terrible guy.
Yeah,
terrible
hysterical.
Dude.
But how do we know that Haman is Memuchan?
Yeah, we know this. We have our sources. That says Haman's Memuchan. So what's the point? The point is that of the seven advisors, who's the lowest advisor? Take my word for it. Who's the lowest advisor? It was Haman. So even when Haman was appointed initially to be part of the entourage or whatever it is, he was still the lowest. And yet he rose. He rose. Oh, text number 8. I love this one. Mike.
Rabbi Kahana said, here we see that a commoner jumps up to the front.
Yeah. It's the guy that doesn't have much seichel. He's like, oh, I've had a good idea. He's right there.
Memuchan means he was from Memuchan.
Possibly.
Like, that was like, you know.
Memuchan. Maybe his other village after.
The village where he.
After Kartzum, after he cut up in Kartzum, he moved, he rolled on to. I'm not sure exactly. Maybe it's possible. Possibly. So, but the point is that he was the younger. He was the smallest, and yet he jumped because that's what happens. Fine. So, what's the point? What's the point of all this? The point is that as the story before the Megillah begins, Haman is low. Haman's not respected. Mordechai is respected. What happens in the middle of the story, or as the story starts unfolding in the Megillah, suddenly things begin to go the other way. Haman begins slowly rising. Mordechai, as part of the Jewish people, they begin to go on the defensive, if you will, right? So now it's like Haman and his decree are the formidable power, and Mordechai and the Jews, they are, God forbid, potentially victims. So everything's switched. What happens at the end of the story? Everyone goes back. So the rabbi asks the question, so what was the point? So what do we accomplish? What was the whole point? Usually a miracle happens because we want something new to come about that's amazing. Nothing new came about. What happened? That Haman is low and Mordechai is high? We had that already. Why did you need this whole thing to make it happen? You understand the question? Mm-hmm. The question makes sense? Made a full circle, so you didn't accomplish anything. You went on a treadmill. Now, you could say, well, what do you mean what was accomplished? There was a decree, and the decree was annulled. Fine, but take a step back. God's running the world.
It's history repeating itself. It's this whole idea of the cycle of history.
But it's almost like if God is running the world, and the world, the scheme or the situation, things were already in a place where it made sense. Mordechai, the Jew, is chashev. He's prominent. He's respected. Haman, the low life, is low. Like, everything's good. So then it flips, and then it flips back. What just happened? So what's the point? It's a unique type of question. Understand the question? It's like a unique type of question. And it's only a question that you can ask if you actually have, like an interesting angle to answer it. Because otherwise, it's like, well, this is how it played out. Things started off good, they got bad, and thank God we got through it. So, yeah, that's what it means. But the Rebbe is asking, if God's running the show, and you already had Mordechai here and Haman down here, so you went like this and this. So I guess, fine, you got the Jews to pray and be on edge for 11 months. Is that it? Is that the whole point? Again, the Rebbe has an angle, sorry.
Wasn't Mordechai, in a
You're saying he didn't have it on the inn.
He was on the outside, and he was also like in a sackcloth.
So, well, he only put that on because he heard the news about the decree. So he put the sackcloth. He put the ashes in the sackcloth on.
But he typically dressed in.
He didn't live in the castle. No, I mean he had attended the Jewish people also. So you're touching on one element of this that the Rebbe then emphasizes, and that is there is something that is accomplished if you look carefully. Although in the beginning Mordechai is higher than Haman, Mordechai is respected, and Haman is the barber. At the end of the story,
his stature is even higher.
And his stature is even lower. It's not, he's not just a barber.
He's a dead
barber. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Dead barbers don't lie.
That's also true. Oh! You guys are killing it. I'm just saying. All right. So, at the end of the story, there is a little bit of a shift, right? Mordechai is not just high; he's very high. Why do we say he's very high? At this point, I want to paraphrase. Text 9a. I think we're up to me anyway. Text 9a and 9b. So this is all from the book of Esther. So it talks about how after Haman is hanged, so Mordechai becomes now the head honcho. And text 9b, so it says the Mordechai's greatness, the king advanced him, he became viceroy. So he's not just at the king's gate. He's not just an advisor or a minister. He is the right-hand man. So Mordechai, at the end of the story, it's not like everything resets back. It goes even higher for Mordechai. And again, Haman is not just a simple barber. He's a dead barber. He's not in the story anymore. So again, one is above the other. It flips back, but it's increased. The Rebbe says this is the core idea, and this is the same thing I mentioned before. You might have clarity in right and wrong, but the initial clarity in right and wrong sometimes needs to be broken, and blurred, and destroyed, and confused in order to reach a deeper level where it's more clarified. Right at the end of the story, it's not like Haman is a little minister, is the seventh, not the most important, but he's also a minister and he's also being asked advice or whatever. At the end, he's gone, and Mordechai is all the way at the top. That's the clarity that you come through. Now let's bring in Woodstock. This sicha, this talk was given at Purim. Woodstock happened in the summer of 69. This is, you know, they say if you can't remember it, you weren't there. If you can't write, if you. I don't remember it. No, wait. It says if you can remember it, you weren't there. If you can remember it, you weren't there.
Right.
Which means if you can remember it, you were there. I can't remember it. What?
You might have been there.
I might have been there, is my point. Okay. Here's the other point. The Rebbe said this 6 months later. This was in the midst of the movement, of the hippie movement. What was a major part of it? Just counter everything. Take the establishment and destroy it. Break it, bomb it, destroy it. Just, right? It doesn't matter. There are rules and establishment. You can't do that. You can't say like that. You can't dress like that. Really? We're going to do it. We're going to break all the rules. The Rebbe had many, many talks on this. What is happening? What is going on? And the Rebbe's angle, which is unbelievable, is that this was the cry of the youth, of a young generation of people who are rebelling against their parents and the societal structure that their parents were building. And what were they building? As the Rebbe says in text, you're gonna love this one. No, we're going past that. Text 11A, 175. The complaints that people have against the younger generation that they are destroying the system, the so-called establishment, should be addressed to their educators. In other words, don't look at them. Go to their educators, their parents, their teachers, their mentors. When parents and teachers taught the younger generation proper behavior, they explained it as the means to be able to afford a nice home, have a large bank account, own two Cadillacs, his and hers. The Rebbe says Cadillac. One for him and one for her. This is an actual translation, and not in parentheses. The Rebbe said in Yiddish, nit ain Cadillac. No, Cadillac. You want to see Cadillac in Hebrew? 1, 2, 3, 4. Four lines from the bottom of the Hebrew. Second to last word on the left side. Cadillac. See that? Four lines up from the bottom.
Right,
second to last word on the 11A. Sorry, in 11A. 11A, have to turn the page back. See it? Cadillac?
Cadillac. Wait a minute. No, I don't see it. So four. Oh, on the right side. Okay. Oh, that's funny.
Oh, maybe it's different pagination. Sorry. Whatever, Cadillac. The Rebbe says, Nit ein Cadillac, not just one Cadillac, nor zwei, but two. Far sich und far der Frau, for you and for your wife. The Rebbe is saying that this is a generation rebelling against this type of thing. Oh, and to be honorees and seated at the head table at banquets. When this constitutes the reason for choosing between good and evil, it is understandable why the youth will ultimately lose all patience for such falsehood. What the Rebbe is saying is that the generation, I guess in the 50s and the 60s, there was a certain structure, there was a certain decorum. But why the decorum? Because of materialism. Because we have to have, the Rebbe said in other talks, wall-to-wall carpeting, which was big then, right? Wall-to-wall carpeting, and Cadillac, shag carpeting, and Cadillacs, and everything nice, and everything like that. And the youth say, why? There's, why such an emphasis on materialism? So instead of wearing the fancy clothes that they could afford, they put on?
Nothing.
Or schleppy clothes, hippie clothes. And instead of grooming themselves, they let it go wild. Right? With beard and long hair. Wait a second. Right? And they acted a bit meshuggah. Instead of following societal norms, they were taking drugs, right? And partying, festivals, etc., Woodstock, etc., 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 right? This is what was going on. And the Rebbe said, oh, the youth out of control. And we know also, right? There was their various underground groups. They were bombing. Anti-Vietnam was going on. Anti-Vietnam was also anti-establishment. The core of anti-Vietnam was anti-establishment. It's like the establishment saying, we have to do this, we have to do that.
We have to fight communism.
Yeah, I have to do this. Really? We say...
peace.
I don't even know what a nice way to say this is. Forget about it to the establishment. Whatever you're saying, we're rejecting. And the Rebbe said, you can blame the youth, rebellious, terrible, or you can realize that what they're rejecting is the falsehood. They're rejecting the false values that they were taught. They were taught right and wrong, not because of right and wrong. They were taught right and wrong because that's what's going to get you ahead in life and make you more money. And the youth are saying, we don't need money. We can find happiness with each other. We don't need clothes. We don't need anything, right? We don't need any of this. We can find happiness in the mud, in Woodstock, with music, and everything is free. We don't need this.
Yeah, but what does that have to do with...
One second. So the Rebbe was saying, you're looking at this generation, everyone's looking and judging and pointing fingers, terrible, corrupt, no values, how did this happen, what's happening? The Rebbe said, no values? Who has the values here? You have the values? Point the finger at the educators. What values were they teaching? Not what did they tell their kids. What did they mean when they told their kids? Where was it coming from? They weren't telling them right from wrong because of the values of right and wrong. Or how to live like a mensch because of the value of being a mensch. It was all about how to get more Cadillacs and more shag carpeting. And the youth saw through it and they rebelled it. They rebelled against it. And the Rebbe said they're not rejecting the values, true values. They're rejecting the false values that are underlying your position of values. It's not real values. Hashtag fake values. This is what they're rebelling against. You with me on this? So the Rebbe said, instead of demeaning, it's too soft of a word, instead of rejecting the youth, embrace what's happening here. The Rebbe saw this as a powerful moment of a societal shift, of people that at their core want something of higher value, even though the expression is anti all those values. They wanted real values. You with me?
Yes.
Sometimes you have to not know the difference between Mordechai and Haman to get a deeper understanding of that difference of right and wrong. Make sense? Mm-hmm. They were breaking the rules because they wanted real rules and not fake rules. Does that make sense?
Well, they wanted to get to what to a higher truth.
Higher truth and higher purpose. Something meaningful, not something fake. Their parents and educators, the whole system was fake. And they saw through it. And they said, we're taking the fake, and we're calling it out as fake, and we're rebelling. It's a widespread generational rebellion against this propped up fakeness. That's how the Rebbe saw it. I believe that this is correct. And it's an unbelievable view. And the Rebbe said, instead of dismissing, shunning, ostracizing, demeaning, etc., the youth, give them something to believe in. Teach them. Lift them up. Show them the truth. Give them something that they can hold on to, and they'll run after it. And you should know, when did the Baal Tshuva movement begin and take off? In the 60s and 70s. You have no idea how many Baal Tshuva, how many people that came back to Torah Mitzvot happened at that time due to the Rebbe's call. Let's read some texts about this. Text 11b. This is in 1976, months after Woodstock. Inasmuch as the youngsters are in the process of a spiritual journey. Listen to what the Rebbe calls it. Not rebellion, a spiritual journey. We cannot allow them to drift and get lost along the way. We must educate them according to their needs in a pleasant and kind manner and lead them to a proper understanding of right and wrong. Because that's what they want. They don't want fake values. They've seen the fake. They've seen the artificial, and they're breaking. They're tearing down the institutions because it's fake. It's run at the core. It's fake. It's built on a false premise. So they're tearing it down. So help them rebuild it with something real. So the Rebbe said, we have something real. This is real. So teach it, share it. This is at a time when you can imagine the most ultra-Orthodox rabbis. Imagine an ultra-Orthodox rabbi looking at the hippies. How did the Rebbe look at hippies? Let's go. This is perfect. This is what we need. We need some people that see through things that are false and that want something real and deep and true. Something meaningful. Something that touches the soul and gets them excited. Let's go. Let's harness the energy. That's how the Rebbe looked at it. Only a Rebbe can see this.
That's so cool.
Only a Rebbe can see this. This is not just a parent with a kid who's rebellious. This is not that. This is an ultra, 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 super, super, ultra Orthodox rabbi in Brooklyn, New York. Looking at, observing what's going on with the hippie movement, with all of the craziness of that, and saying, not this is treif, this is terrible, how dare they, feh, but saying, come on in, this is it. You guys are on the right track. You guys are on the right track. You're breaking down the falsehood. Now let's go, let's teach you some Torah, let's rally the movement. This is a Rebbe. This is a true leader. This is a true leader. Now, I know I'm now observing the observer. Right? The Rebbe is observing this, and now I'm observing the Rebbe on this. But I can't help myself. So that's not the point. The point, though, here is that sometimes to reach a deeper place of depth, of understanding right and wrong, you have to break down. And in the interim, you may do things that are not so right. Right? It's not like the Rebbe was saying that everything they're doing is kosher. But it's a process of they've torn down those artificial structures of right and wrong, and now they're in the space of chaos where right is wrong and wrong is right and everything is confused. That inebriated state of not knowing the difference between Haman and Mordechai. That's the state that they're at, only so that they can hopefully arrive at a deeper state of clarity. Blessed be Mordechai and cursed be Haman.
But could you take that one step further, in that the sort of the revenge killings that went on is part of that sort of almost like this chaotic inebriated state, because from there came the higher state of Jews that didn't result in the killing.
So it's hard to comment on actual loss of life and then put into this. So there's a lot to be looked at when it comes to this. The Rebbe, I think, was speaking a little bit more generally, not specifically about any one action. Although I did read a story where the Rebbe spoke to somebody who was becoming more religious but was hesitant to grow a beard. This was in the 70s. And the Rebbe said, look at the hippie movement. Grow a beard. Be a hippie. And the Rebbe quoted these names of like the great leaders of the hippie movement and the counterculture and anti-war. A lot of them were Jews. The Rebbe said, look, this guy's Jewish, and they have beards. Join the club. But so the Rebbe did cite some of these guys that eventually, you know, one of them was involved in bombings and whatever. I'm not saying therefore it's kosher or whatever. I'm just a reference in a story. But the point here is, the way the Rebbe is looking at it, why on Purim does the Talmud say that you're supposed to be inebriated to the point where you don't know the difference between cursed be Mordechai, cursed be Haman, and blessed be Mordechai? Doesn't make sense. The whole point of Purim is to have that clarity of who's right and who's wrong. And the Rebbe is basically saying that, just look at the story arc. Before the Megillah, we know, right, Mordechai and Haman are clearly delineated. In the middle of the story of the Book of Esther, it's confused. Maybe Haman's better. Maybe Mordechai is not so cool. We don't know who's right and who's wrong, or who's higher, who's lower. At the end, it's clarified again. Sometimes, to go from a very immature, if you will, understanding, to go to a more mature understanding, in the interim, there's going to be chaos. The point is, for each of us, here's my personal takeaway. I'm so personal, but here's my, I guess, maybe individualized takeaway. There's certain truths that we each have, but maybe we have those truths because we were told those truths. Sometimes, to really embrace the truth, you need to challenge the truth. You need to challenge that idea. And really challenge it to the point that you don't know if it's right or wrong, to then arrive at a deeper understanding of the depth of it. Like, again, okay, so I'll speak personally. So growing up, as I did, in a religious home, observant home, and Chabad home, so a lot of the things that, let's talk about like the daily practices, a lot of those things are very relatively easy for me. Why do I say easy? Because they're all I know. So to me, what tonight's class means is not to be satisfied with those lines and those delineations and the structure that exists almost by default, but to challenge them. And not necessarily to challenge them to the point where you throw it all away and then re-embrace it, maybe it doesn't go that far, but to challenge it, at least in the emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, to the point that you discard the truth just because you were told it was the truth, and you embrace a new truth because you've discovered it to be true. And then it's yours. And then it's deep. And then it's meaningful. And then it's something you can really live by. So I think for all of us, there are all things in our lives that are good, but can be better. And the question is, how do you go from good to better? Sometimes you have to get rid of the good, at least for a moment, to have something better. Does that make sense? Sort of. Yes. It's probably better if it's a little bit more vague. That way, we can all apply it on our own.
I think, but as I understand that, if you're taking it because that's how you were taught, and you accepted it because of who taught it, it still isn't authentically you until you
you challenge it and test it.
Like a proof. So how does that resonate for you? And then that's when it becomes really real.
Right. And the message for all of us. So this is to take, not to do away with the good stuff, keep the good stuff, but develop. But make it, number one, make it real, and number two, make it that much deeper. Make it that much deeper. So this, again, is it's also a spiritual way of understanding the Talmudic call. So the Talmud says, Rava says, it's a mitzvah to drink on Purim until you don't know the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. So our question was, why? Why? That's blurring the lines of the story. And the answer is, it's exactly what we're looking to do. We're looking to blur the lines to then sharpen them on a much deeper level.
Isn't it also sometimes that we don't recognize our blessings until, I don't want to use, God forbid, the word curse, but you know that there is that, there are often those times where we do get so entrenched in our own truths that we overlook are blessings, and it's only when we those lines are blurred between blessing and curse
that you can that really you, appreciate what you have.
You can really appreciate what you
yeah.
have, or you know, take the essence of living to a high and
yeah.
life and to a higher level. It's really interesting because the Rebbe really was very that was a very modernist. Philosophy.
It's unbelievable.
That's like so post-structuralist.
You know,
it's
a Rebbe is not. The more you learn from the Rebbe, the more you realize that the vision is not stuck in any box. The moment you have the Rebbe figured out, it's like.
Take a look
at this. Look at this. Look at text 13. We are currently in the era before Mashiach, an era which the Talmud says is full of brazenness when young people shame their elders. That's what the Talmud says. And it seems to be like a negative thing. The Rebbe says, it's happening now, baby. But look how the Rebbe embraces it. Among those who work with young people, there are some who claim that now is not the time to demand of their students to accept Torah and Mitzvot and the yoke of heaven. If our students have refused to accept upon themselves the relatively simple things that we've demanded from them until now, they say, certainly they will not accept upon themselves the weighty responsibility of Torah and Mitzvot and the yoke of heaven now, basically, with this whole movement. This is 1968. 2 years before. Torah mitzvah must be kept not only on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Shabbat, and holidays, but on every single day of the year, all day long. If they refuse to accept the minor responsibility, how can we approach them about this? The answer is that especially because they are giants, therefore the land is very, very good. Okay, that's a reference to the previous text. Precisely because they are brazen and possess real chutzpah and do not care what the world thinks of them or what their siblings and parents think, etc. Rather, they say it's a free country and do as they please, as we have seen in the last few days in the forms of strikes, etc. Precisely because they are not influenced by anything, now is the time that the land is very, very good. The Rebbe is saying, these people, they don't care. Perfect. This is exactly who we need, who we want, who can make a transformation. By explaining to these people the true path, they will be transformed. Not only will they begin to observe Torah and Mitzvot, but they will transform the entire world, for they see the world from the top down. They have a bigger view of things. The Rebbe looked at counterculture, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and today. Sounds like a radio station. The Rebbe looked at the revolution of the 60s and 70s as one of the greatest spiritual forces in history. All you need to do is know how to look at it and channel it. In the interim, it might look a bit messy. But so does the story of Purim. Until you transform the inebriation to a deeper appreciation of right and wrong. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.